a kid who thinks he knows a heck of a lot more than he has the faintest idea what exists. You know, talk about people who don't know enough to realize that they don't know anything. This seems to be very common. Now, occasionally, you meet very, very smart kids, but a lot of them are just kind of, they make assumptions about everything. And one of the things that I listen to sites that are filled with Zoomer types, and the general insult of people like us are calling us boomers. There are about 3,000 derogatory qualities that they espouse to boomers.
I have a few thoughts on that.
Certainly, please. Yes, I agree. Share.
There's something I did with my own kids, and I think it was the right thing. Basically, I made a point. Every time when we sat down to dinner, I would ask them both, so what happened in school today, or what happened today? And we would have an intelligent discussion about it, and they came out pretty good.
Well, good for you. We talked during the dinner hour. We didn't really talk about ourselves. We kind of talked about stuff in the news. My father, may he rest in peace, was really into politics. He never read the sports page. He wouldn't know anything about football or baseball or any of that, but he could tell you who was the district leader for the Liberal Party in a particular district off the top of his head. So we kind of talked politics, and I was the youngest in the group. My sister was 5 years older and had a lot of very liberal friends. And although, you know, my father was an old-time Democrat, you know, in those days, an old-time Democrat was kind of a moderately conservative type of a person. So it was interesting listening to the arguments being thrown back and forth.
Where did you live when you were a kid?
Same place here, just about a stone's throw from Coney Island in Gravesend.
Oh, so you were right near me from the time I was 15 till I got married.
Yep, it's a small world.
It sure is.
Then again, if you're less than 50 years, but if more than 15 years younger than me, maybe not.
Well, I think I get, before less than 15 years. Either way, it's interesting. Lovely neighborhood. I've always enjoyed this neighborhood. It's interesting. It was an interesting mix of Jewish and Italian. There was a known mafioso funeral home in one of the corners that eventually got sold off to a medical facility. There's a bowling alley. We've talked about it, I think, before. And nice neighborhood, nice middle-class neighborhood.
One more question. I guess I have it. What were you doing in October of 1967 when the D train became the F train?
Let's see. Probably that was my senior year in PS216 elementary school, because when I graduated, I had to go to David A. Booty, and I used the F train to get there. So that was the following year.
Did you realize until October 67 that line was the D train?
Well, nowadays I do, but back in those days I probably wasn't aware of the designation of the subway. Although probably on the entranceway they have the the designation of the trains that stop there, so I don't know if it really connected in my head. Because there was a very close exit, the Avenue X exit of the Independent Line is only about five blocks away from here. So I'm sure I passed by it, whether I looked up and remembered that it said D at one point and then changed to F. I don't recall that.
I will never forget that. I was commuting by subway to college, and they had put up signs for months and months and months, and it appears that I was the only one who studied up on what was changing. And the Monday morning with the new train routes and everything was absolute chaos. And basically, I had people like lining up to ask me what they should do, because I was the only one who had a clue.
Well, so you were like you are today, but even back then, I wasn't really that much aware of things. I do recall later on at McDonald Avenue when they finally decided to fill in the trolley tracks. There were trolley tracks from the old electric trolley system that they had kind of just had embedded in the asphalt that they hadn't covered over until I guess I was someplace in junior high school that they finally figured out that that was probably going to be a good idea.
I occasionally go to Northport. There's an old movie theater that they turned into a, regional theater in Northport. Occasionally, the SYL and I go to see a play there. And I think they still have the trolley tracks in the middle of the main street.
Yeah, I'm sure there are still trolley tracks that no one's bothered to either remove or just cover up. Remembering the good old days or not having enough money in the budget. So I'm sure there are trolley tracks out there, but I in my mind's eye, I can still remember the McDonald Avenue trolley tracks that were part of my childhood.
By the way, east of New Haven, Connecticut, I haven't been there in about 10 years, but I believe it's still there. There's a trolley car museum where you can ride on a restored old trolley.
Oh, that would be interesting. I've never actually seen real trolleys. I've seen movies, San Francisco trolleys and other trolleys, but I've the only thing I've actually seen in person were the tracks. I've never seen the actual trolleys that were connected to the tracks. That would be interesting.
Keep in mind, I haven't been to San Francisco in a while, but it has both trolleys and cable cars, and do not confuse the two.
Okay. Yeah. I think they have a better appreciation for the past than most areas of the country where the latest, greatest new thing, takes precedent. So, it's a nice little folksy touch they have. I remember the commercials. You saw the cable cars in the commercials for the, what was it, rice or something?
Rice or wrong, it's just so true.
Yeah.
It certainly was. PhD, coming.
Yes, Jim.
I love the Brooklyn nostalgia. I would want to go on and on about it. But I'm really curious. I think Ed had something technical to talk about tonight.
Yes, indeed. Airplanes are in the news once again. They do interesting things, and I thought it would be nice if Ed could comment on it. He made a comment on the previous problem with Boeing's MAX airplane, so I thought it would be a nice bookend type of thing. So, Ed, if you want to give us a little rendition of what took place recently, I'd appreciate it.
Thanks, Chris.
Say again? Yeah, unfortunately, your amplitude is low and your noise is high, so I can't really make out much. If there's a way for you to get a stronger signal into the repeater, or maybe try talking very loudly into the microphone, maybe that'll help.
W2LVQ, any better?
Yes, much better.
I appreciate that, and I'm listening. This is a very interesting conversation.
Okay, very good. What's your first name, sir?
First name is Ron, R-O-N.
Okay, very good, Ron. Glad to have you aboard. If you ever come up with any questions, hopefully you'll come by and then share them with us, and they'll be grist for our mill. But sit back, listen, enjoy yourself, and we're glad to have you. You're welcome. So, Ed, would you like to share your insights with us about the new Boeing MAX problem? And if you want to discuss the Japanese disaster recently?
I can't really call the Japanese one a disaster because miraculously it turned out a lot better than everybody would have expected. It was almost a near disaster. On the other hand, five people did die. But here's my question. I am fully prepared to discuss both. Any preference which goes first or which one I should or shouldn't do?
Hi, I don't have a problem with you doing both. I mean, it depends with the Japanese thing. If you look at on the side of the Coast Guards, it was a disaster. All five of them died. It was kind of a miracle that the passenger ship and the people running it survived on their end. So, yeah, I guess it's kind of half-empty, half-full type of situation. As far as I'm concerned, you can do it in any order that you want. Probably the biggest bang for your buck to start with, I think, would be the Boeing MAX because, although no one died, it seems to have made more of a international noise than the Japanese problem. Disaster or semi-disaster was.
Okay, but let me just correct one thing. On the Coast Guard plane, five people died. The sixth, the pilot, did survive. But we'll put that in abeyance for the moment, and let me discuss the Alaska Air 737 MAX 9. Now, the 737 MAX 9 is a new aircraft. Back when the 738 MAX 8 fiasco happened back in 2018, the MAX 9 was, just on the drawing board. But now it is currently being sold as a new plane. And the aircraft in question apparently was delivered to Alaska Airlines on October 31st, Halloween. At first, it sounded like a window blew out, but it turns out it's a little more complicated than that. The 738 MAX 9 is a bigger airplane than the previous iterations of the 737. And there are regulations on how many doors an airplane must have, dependent primarily on the number of passengers. Like, if you've ever flown on a 747, there are doors all over the place, because that's what you need with that many passengers. And unlike most narrow-body planes, the 738 MAX 9 has enough passenger capacity that it kind of is on the borderline of needing rear doors. And so what they do is, when an airline orders one, depending upon seating and the like, they should either require the doors or not require them. Apparently, Alaskan Airlines spread the seats out a little bit further than some other airlines do, and they kept it below the threshold where they needed the rear doors. So what they basically did was put in a kind of a quasi-door with a window in it, but with no hinges or anything. It just fastens in place. So they're flying around where you can see this, like, outline of a door around the window. And that's what blew out. Now, there are several possibilities. Let me drop. A total failure of the fuselage structure is usually on very, very old airplanes, you know, decades old, where you get, like, metal fatigue from all of the flexing. And that causes problems like this. On the other hand, a brand new airplane might have some kind of a latent defect that doesn't show up immediately, but it will show up pretty quickly. Whereas this one didn't really quite fit either profile, because in over 2 months, unless it was kept parked, which I find hard to believe, because those airplanes are so expensive that the airlines have to keep them flying constantly to make the payments. It had probably hundreds of cycles. Let me just drop and explain what I mean by that. When you're flying in an airliner at 30,000 feet, the air pressure inside the plane is roughly equivalent to what you get naturally in Denver, Colorado. A little bit less, about 6,000, maybe 7,000 feet effective air pressure. And the reason for that is, if you went 14.7 PSI, full sea level atmospheric pressure, the stress on the fuselage from all that air pressing out is incredible. So, you know, at 30,000 feet, you're down to only a few PSI. So, what they do is, by raising it to about 6,000 feet or so, you tremendously reduce the stress. But you still have huge forces tending to blow the fuselage apart. But think about it. 14.7 PSI doesn't sound like much, but I just did a little, as Einstein said, a thought experiment. My hand is about 7 inches long and about 4 inches wide. Now, it's not quite a rectangle, so instead of 28 square inches, let's say 20 square inches. So if I'm flying a plane and I put my hand up against the wall, the air is putting 300 pounds there, roughly. You know, if I'm at, we're at altitude, we're at 50 foot, you know, at sea level. And at 6,000 feet, it still is, like, you know, effective inside pressure. It's still 200 pounds in an area the size of my hand. So you add that up over the entire inner surface of the airplane. It's a huge amount of force. So it is under tremendous strain. So it's not totally shocking that, particularly maybe if something isn't installed properly, there's enough force that I could rip it out. Let me drop. By the way, so far so good, Roy?
Yep.
I did see one photograph that showed the outline of the door from the inside. And it was very weird because I saw these little metallic things. I have a keychain that's a thumb drive, you know, a little keychain on it, it's a thumb drive. And it's like a little, it's about with a little rectangle, I don't know, what's it about? 2 inches long, half an inch wide, quarter inch thick. But the back of it, the way, you know, part away from where you plug it in, is rounded off with a rather large circle to go, you know, to feed the kids sand through. And I saw some protuberances that reminded me of that. It was a little thing sticking out from the hole. Obviously, to bolt the door, you know, the fake door onto. But what bothered me is the holes were intact, nothing ripped out. You know, it didn't rip through the rim around the hole. So that was something. I have no idea what that means. I'm just spitballing here. But I would think in a case like that, you'd find those things would have, you know, been ripped to shreds as they've been pulled out. Let me drop.
W2BZ.
BZ, go ahead.
Yeah, I just want to tell Roy that I have a question after everybody's done.
Okay. All right, so let me continue here. Now, here's where this gets strange. I'm assuming, and it's possible I'm wrong, that this plane was put into service almost immediately. And in 2.5 months, it's probably done a couple of hundred cycles from no strain on the fuselage up to, like I said, 200 pounds per my hand on the fuselage, and back down again, and up again, and down again, you know, every you know, flight segment. And usually, you know, these planes, you know, usually fly about, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8 fairly short flight segments in a day before they, you know, park, you know, in the wee hours of the morning. So it's constantly up and down, up and down, up and down. Now, either metal fatigue, which I can't believe on such a new airplane, and the problem, like I said, with a manufacturing defect, why would it take hundreds of cycles to suddenly, instantly, without warning, fail? You know, after a few hundred cycles, if there was something wrong, I think it wouldn't be all or nothing. There would have been some hints about it, which reminds me of that submersible disaster a few months ago. There were hints. You know, after the fact, we heard that it had been trying to, you know, it was yelling, you know, hey guys, there's something wrong, but nobody was listening. You know, like for months, if not years. But anyway, in this case, there was no warning whatsoever, and suddenly it let go. But here's what's driving me crazy. It let go climbing at 16,000 feet. Let me drop it. Let us say you're doing an experiment. Let's say it's some kind of a balloon. You know, a serious balloon, not a little, you know, frivolous kid's balloon. You blow it up to a pressure. You deflate it. You blow it up to a pressure. You deflate it. You blow it up to a pressure. You deflate it. Maybe one day you'll blow it up to pressure, and at full pressure, the balloon will pop. But in this case, the balloon popped at half pressure when it probably had been at full pressure, you know, a few hours ago. So that's what really, really, really baffles me about it. So, have I made a clear case of, you know, what do you say, an educated way of being baffled?
Yes, I would think so. Jim, you want to say something?
Thank you. KDUBHD. Ed, interesting observations. I happened to attend the, not the immediate crash, but the aftermath a few hours later of flight 587 that went down to Rockaway, where there was, we were tasked to search the tail area of the plane. And it was very noteworthy that, I don't know much about planes, but there was these bolts, spots, and brackets, and stuff like that, and a pin, and a ferrule. These are my words, I don't know if they're accurate. But the vertical stabilizer was just gone. It was gone. As if it had been beamed up by Scotty to the Enterprise. And I think we've been dealing with metallurgical differences for eons on our planet, but these things where we're dealing with composites, high technology composites interacting with metallic attachment points. I don't think we've mastered that. That's my take on the situation. I can go on, but I'm sure you can go with that. Over to Ned.
I do have an answer for you. I am familiar with that.
I remain listening.
All right, with you, Roy?
Yep, go ahead.
All right, I am quite familiar with that case. That was right after 9/11, and everybody was totally hysterical. And I remember when they said, no, this is not terrorism. It was a mix between, you know, disbelief or belief or what have you. But what you saw was what happened that caused the crash. You did not see the result of the crash. What you referenced, I'm sure there's a lot of stuff that the crash caused. But the cause of the crash, because this was fairly new in the era of carbon fiber. And there were some fairly strict limitations on how much maneuvering the planes had to be kept to. And I never did get a real handle on why the flight crew exceeded those limitations, but they did some maneuvers that significantly exceeded the rating of the carbon fiber empennage, use the fancy term, but basically, you know, the tail of the plane, the vertical and horizontal stabilizers. And it catastrophically failed, which left the plane unstable and unable to fly. Now, since that happened, or more precisely, after that happened, there was a tremendous effort, two-pronged effort, on one, to make sure all pilots knew exactly how far they could push and where to stop, and to improve the carbon fiber construction. And you will note, it has not happened since. And I don't think that's a coincidence. I think they put the effort in and they cleaned up the mess. Jim?
It's a very interesting topic. I myself am exposed to a little bit. My son's involved with bicycles and carbon fiber in that field. And I prefer an aluminum bicycle. You'll bend it before you break it. And it depends on what your goal is. Resiliency, robustness, or efficiency. You can't have them all. And the carbon fiber is harder to predict. I assume it's predictable. I think you'll add some more to that conversation that's above my ability to add. But metal, we understand. Carbon fiber, I don't think we fully understand it, and we may not for decades.
Keep in mind, that accident was decades ago. We've come a long way. Have we achieved nirvana yet? Probably not, but we're a lot closer now than we were then in that regard. Not in others.
K2NTH with a comment.
Comment, go.
Yeah, so I think you raised some really, first of all, so I'm a pilot, so I think the accident in question was of much interest. And I think one of the elements relative to what you talked about in terms of the rudder breaking is, and it was sort of quite controversial amongst pilots, is that the rudder broke off below what's called the maximum maneuvering speed on the aircraft. And put simply, the maximum maneuverable speed is the point at which you should be able to fully deflect the flight control surfaces without having them break off. Let me stop for a sec. And so the controversial thing in the pilot community, at least, was the rut broke when the aircraft was below the maximum maneuverable speed, where, in theory, you could fully deflect the control surfaces and not have them break off. And pilots are trained very much on that because, obviously, the control surfaces breaking off would be not good. And so, you know, one of the interesting aspects of that crash was the fact that it appears the the control surface broke, even though they were below that speed. And I think that caused, you know, a lot of commentary amongst the pilot community, because that was always thought that below that speed you could effectively maximum deflect the control surface and not have a break off. So just throwing that out there, because that was definitely a controversial bit of that crash. Over.
PhD, please.
Go ahead.
That is valuable insight. It's very illustrative of the situation. But I think what it leaves out is the fact that with carbon fiber as opposed to metallic structures, the malleability is very different, and we don't truly understand it fully, I don't think. You know, others will disagree, I'm sure. But when you make that turn on a carbon fiber tail of an airplane, you're not just making the turn on that turn. You're making a turn on the whole history of that device, that's its whole lifespan. And that's the part that we don't get. I'll leave it at that to you more technical folks to tear apart. PhD, thank you.
I would say that's what I'm watching for this today. There's been tremendous progress in the past, I guess it's 22 years. But yeah, dude, there's a long history of things like that. History is full of, disasters that happened when people went a little too far. I mean, Galloping Gertie, the Tacoma Narrows Bridge that collapsed due to wind resonance, is an example of that sort of thing. Sometimes you learn the hard way. The Lockheed Electra. When the Lockheed Electra turboprop airliner came out in the early 50s, and by the way, I've flown on Electras, a couple of them blew up in midair. And it turned out there was some kind of a vibration resonance issue, and they grounded them. They figured out what it was. They solved it. And every time you see a P-3, a Navy P-3, flying with the Hurricane Hunters or doing search and rescue missions, it's an Electra. They're still flying today, like 50 years later. So, yeah, it's not just carbon fiber. That's true across the board.
Our thought?
Go ahead.
So, Hurricane Hunter is a perfect example of, if a Hurricane Hunter folds in half in a storm and crashes to the ground, was the failure caused by that storm or seven storms earlier when it was stressed beyond its elastic, you know the phrase, I can't think of it right now. It was damaged seven flights ago, and this is the one where it failed. We have a little bit of understanding of that with metallic things, and it's not a crystal ball, but it's... But carbon fiber and those things, I think it's not as predictable, at least to us now.
I don't believe a Hurricane Hunter plane has ever been lost in a hurricane. They may have been lost during some mundane nonsense, I don't know, but I don't think that scenario you spoke about has ever happened. I will tell you, I've met people who flew with the Hurricane Hunters, and they say that is one ride. And my comment is, if you want to know what macho is, the guys and gals who get on those planes, that's macho. You are bounced around. I mean, if you're not strapped in, you would be flying like a ping pong ball across that plane.
K2NGH with a comment.
Comment, go.
Yeah, so I just to come back for a moment to the incident with the Alaska Airlines crash. We're talking a lot about metal fatigue, but one of the theories out there, and obviously we need to wait for the full investigation, but there's questions about whether the panel in question was installed properly, and that's been raised because of a series of recent issues with Boeing aircraft having manufacturing issues. There was a few months prior issues with the rudder where there were bolts not installed correctly. A couple years prior to that, there was planes that were sent out that had tools and rags that were found in the fuel tanks. And so there's a lot of questions about the integrity of the manufacturing process and whether or not, you know, for example, did they not install a bolt correctly. And so that's another possibility beyond the whole metal fatigue issue.
Absolutely, I agree 100%. My only question is, something like that, why did it let go at 15,000 feet, which is far less stress on the structure than it has probably been since the plane was put into service on October 31st? It's probably been up to full stress. I mean, the maximum stress on that, your depressurization, is when you're flying at about 30,000 feet. You've probably been there a few hundred times, as recently as a few hours before. And then half stress at 15,000 feet, it slowly lets go. That's my only question about that. Otherwise, I agree with you 100%.
Okay, so I'm the follow-up.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I think, I mean, I'm sure the NTSB is looking at it, and they'll certainly come up with their findings. I think one just other data point to throw out there is that it's been reported that that particular aircraft had pressurization issues in flights leading up to the particular instance. And, you know, that's not completely uncommon. Sometimes things happen where the aircraft struggles to pressurize on the way up, but certainly something the NTSB will look at is was that actually a sign that there was early issues that were not, you know, that were actually leading up to this catastrophic failure, where it eventually went out.
Yeah, another theory. I was talking to my son about this, and we were bouncing around, and we thought it's possible that it was something that happened to the plane. Like maybe they were doing some routine maintenance and something got hit. Or maybe they removed some access panel there just for some routine inspection or something. They didn't put it back right or something. But yeah, definitely something along those lines. Because I think we can say with a 2-month-old airplane, it was not metal fatigue.
K10JH, follow-up.
BHD. HJH and BHD.
Yeah, so quick, on that point you mentioned, I don't, there's nothing to suggest per se that that happened here, but there was an interesting case a few months back in the UK where an airplane was being used for a film shoot, and they had these very intense lights that they were shining on the side of the plane for an extended period, and the flight afterwards, windows blew off the flight, and it turned out that the movie lights they were using essentially melted the compound that held the windows in place. And on the flight afterwards, the windows departed the aircraft, and it was attributed to this intense lighting that was being used as part of this film shoot they were doing.
I hope nobody was hurt.
Nobody was hurt in that case, thankfully. And on that point, too, the other kind of extraordinary aspect of this flight was there was nobody sitting in the seat right next to where this blowout occurred, which is a very fortunate coincidence, because had somebody been sitting there, it's very likely they would have been seriously injured, if not potentially killed. And you may remember, unfortunately, there was a Southwest incident several years ago where an engine had a catastrophic failure that punctured a hole in the side of the aircraft, and unfortunately, you know, the only fatality on that was the individual sitting right there. So it's a small miracle that nobody happened to be sitting in the seat right next to where this occurred.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Wasn't there a Hawaiian plane about 15 years ago that had, you know, been flying for years and years and years doing very short hops, you know, like 20, 30 short hops a day due to metal fatigue? Part of the fuselage ripped apart
and there was a guy sitting there who was belted in. He was completely unhurt, but he said that was the ride of a lifetime, and he does not want to do it again.
I think it was even longer ago. It was sometime in the 80s, I believe. But yes, there was an airplane in Hawaii, suffered a pretty catastrophic structural failure, took off not just a panel, but an entire section of the upper fuselage. And, unfortunately, I believe it was a flight attendant, unfortunately, got sucked out when that happened. But the passengers that were strapped in, yeah, they got quite the ride, but they landed safely afterwards. But yeah, there's photos of that one, and that was far more dramatic than what took place here.
All right, Jim, your turn, WB2AB.
So I remain suspicious of situations where there's dissimilar materials connected together. It was clear to me in the Rockaway crash that I don't know anything about airplanes, but there was this tail and there was this amazingly beefy-looking arrangement of how the vertical element was bolted to the plane with sleeves and bolts. It was huge. And there was not a trace of the carbon fiber tail sticking up. It was gone. So all of the metallic elements were there, totally undisturbed. It was the only part of the plane that wasn't disturbed. The plane was shredded to nail-sized shards. But the tail was completely intact. And the bolts, whatever they're called, that connected the tail to the elevator, were all pristine. It was bizarre. And the tail was gone. And before that and after that, I've learned to respect that when you get dissimilar materials together, you have unpredictable results. And I think we in the big picture, have not appreciated that as much as we need to. Maybe just fixed in the last 20 years, but I doubt it.
All right, Jim, first of all, I have to disagree with you. You say you know nothing about airplanes, but you keep proving that you're wrong. You seem to know a fair amount about airplanes. So give yourself, don't denigrate yourself. But that's good. No, I understand your point fully. I understand. All I can say is, the good news is, we haven't had a repeat. So that shows they took it seriously. And I'm saying it's never going to happen again, but it will happen under much more stressful conditions if it does.
Thank you, agreed. But my point is that sometimes or all the times, the damage that causes the crash came from some previous incident in these cases that the material doesn't leave a record of, and the records don't leave a record of, and it happens because of a weakness from something that happened previously. And we need to appreciate that.
I guess the ultimate of that was the Columbia Space Shuttle, that the heat shield got damaged on takeoff. And then when they were under reentry, they had a catastrophic failure because of a defect that happened to take off. And I'm sure there are many, many, many other cases like that. But yeah, there are many cases where some damage is done and it doesn't, or it weakens something, so it's more susceptible to a stress failure. Let me give you a personal example, totally irrelevant. It's a cute story. Let me just have a drop. Once upon a time where I was working, there was this woman working there who was, this was early in the days of what was known as women's liberation, and she was an avid pro-women. Although what bothered me wasn't that she was so pro-women, is that, everything was an insult to her. Anyway, she had a Oldsmobile Toronado, which is like one of the first cars with front-wheel drive. And it had this huge hood, and there was obviously a lot of stress on the front wheels. And one day, I noticed one of the lug nuts was missing. Not the lug nuts, but the nut and the stud. All right. I'm sure she'll get it fixed. A week later, I noticed there were two. At which point, I said to her, you know, I knew I was going to get my head ripped off of this, and I wasn't disappointed. And I said, you really have to take care of that. And she ripped into me for mansplaining and blah, 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 blah. And I lost it. And I said, I'm sorry. I apologize for upsetting you. But I just would feel terrible if you turned into a red stain on the LIE. And a friend of mine told me the next day, you know, after your little chat, she went and had it fixed. But the point I'm saying is, the first stud broke off, which weakened it, and the second stud broke off, and what that meant, 3, 4, and 5, was on the verge of letting go momentarily, which I think matches your point, regardless of whether or not you like the rest of the story. Jim, that was terrible. You had this bubbly sound. No, Jim, that last transmission, your audio was like breaking up with this bubbly sound. Roy, you confirm it wasn't me?
No, it wasn't you. It was the All-Star link between the two repeaters. It went wonky on us all.
By the way, did you like the social aspect, you know, social, non-technical aspects of that story?
Yeah, sure. I just want to point out for, hopefully Jim is still hearing us, because his relay was completely gone towards the end, that, you know, composite materials like carbon fiber are much, much, much more difficult to computer model. And so to do it right, you have to actually expose these things to the environment that you're testing them for. And as long as you're aware, and these material guys are very aware of all the characteristics of these composite materials, you know, they can get it right. Occasionally, they get it wrong. Metals can have metal fatigue, can have other problems. You could have tempering problems. Metallurgy is a sophisticated science, so you could screw things up with metals. It's just a lot easier to screw things up with carbon fibers.
Given enough set it all, Roy, you can screw anything up, Roy.
That's correct. That's why I don't want people to kind of leave this technical net with the idea that carbon fiber is bad, metal's good. Metals are great, but the promise of carbon fibers is a real one if you know what you're doing. It requires a much more sophisticated understanding than with metallurgy, which itself requires a very sophisticated understanding, which is above our pay grade.
PhD.
Ah, he's back.
I think the link broke down for a minute there. Sorry. Carbon fiber is great. It's amazing. Metal is great. It's amazing. If you stick them together, I don't think we fully respect the problems that come of it yet. That's my feeling.
Well, I mean, the problem is, as far as I'm aware, there's a lot of places where they put them together. You can put them together right, you can put them together wrong. One of the perfect examples of putting them together extremely wrong was that submersible that was mentioned earlier tonight.
I got another one that's closer to home. Aluminum house wiring. Nowadays, there are big signs on stuff. Never, ever, ever intermix aluminum wire and brass screws.
Yeah, there was a lot of errors. What was it, back in the late 60s, early 70s, aluminum electrical wiring was a new good thing out there until it was a terrible thing?
I wouldn't say terrible. It wasn't understood and it caused some terrible things, yes, yes. And then when they realized and they basically came up with some ground rules that are quite restrictive, but you still can do it, but there are a lot of rules you got to follow.
I think it's important to understand that it's at the conjunction of the differences, the deltas, the differences of the materials where the problems arise. You can make a whole thing out of aluminum, you can make it out of steel, you can make it out of stainless steel, you can make it out of copper. But when you mix them, weird things happen. And that needs to be appreciated much more than this, I think, in the big picture. Not just from, like, engineers and technologists, but by the average schmo. When you put dissimilar materials together, interesting things happen. Sometimes they're good, sometimes they're bad.
I think the ultimate of that is the bimetallic strip uses so many inexpensive thermostatic devices.
Good example.
Yeah, I mean, obviously there are places for this technology and places where you should understand galvanic corrosion, especially in boats. But I believe that submersible that we talked about had a lot of dissimilar metals in contact with each other and a lot of opportunities for galvanic corrosion as well. Yeah, you know, like all things, you have to appreciate and attempt at least to understand the basics of the technologies involved. And some of them are unfortunately too esoteric for some. You know, you occasionally have these strange guys videotaped knocking down a house without the faintest idea of to cut off the gas line while you're banging through a wall that has a gas line. So a lot of people make a lot of foolish mistakes, unfortunately. Again, I think our education system is not quite up to the job of educating people.
Roy, I think that submersible and the Titanic have a tremendous amount in common. And what they have in common is human arrogance, hubris, and, you know, failing to pay, you know, failing to admit maybe they don't know everything.
I agree. The death certificate should have listed hubris as the cause of death. The guy who was the captain was the most arrogant, entitled, rich bastard that I've ever seen. And more than a few people suggested he was going to get everyone killed, and he kind of said, "Hey, you're just a chicken," type of thing. It's you know, there's more than enough footage of him basically saying, "Yeah, well, it's risky. Life is risky, but let's go for the gusto." So yeah, hubris killed him as much as anything else, as much as metal fatigue or secondhand carbon fibers did.
When was that guy born? Don't look it up. The reason I'm saying is because he's been the reincarnation of the owner of the White Star Line who played that role with the Titanic.
I think he was basically someplace around 60 years old.
No, I'm just making
a
bad reincarnation joke. But the president of the White Star Line played the exact same role on the sinking of the Titanic.
Yeah, I think I saw some video where they took a piece of the film and they compared the two of them. I don't know. I think this particular guy, there's a lot more footage of him being really more entitled than anyone else. So although that guy was sort of a business version, this guy, you know, I couldn't take him seriously in business. He was a carny, you know. He, you know, I mean, he kind of reeked of a grift.
Well, Yeah, we all come across people like that occasionally, but thankfully most of them don't have, aren't in a position to do that much damage.
Yeah, fortunately, that's right. I mean, of the group of unfortunate people who died in that submersible, the one I really feel the worst for is one of the billionaires guilted his son, apparently, as a Father's Day present to go with him down in the submersible. The kid, as far as I'm aware, didn't want any part of it, but he finally was guilted into it and died because of guilt.
The only consolation to that is you probably, well, I don't know. I think it was almost instantaneous. I don't think he had to, I don't think he had enough time to mull over what you're talking about. In any event, should I go on to the other one in Japan?
Well, I think Rich wanted to ask a question. Could we save that for next week, maybe?
May even learn more, sure.
Okay, so we'll save that until next week. Thank you so much, Ed. I really do appreciate it. And thanks for Jim participating and for Hank. Long time no hear, Hank. I hope everything is well with you. Happy and healthy New Year. Rich, do you want to do your question now?
You know, I would rather do it next week, if that's okay. I could do it now, but I don't, you know, want to run too heavily into the space report.
Okay, Ed, can you do the Japanese plane disaster in 15 minutes?
Well, it depends. Let me get Hank's take on that. The, you know, the airline pilot. Are you okay with that? Because I can tell you right now, I am going to say some things for the general audience that I know are technically inaccurate, such as the defective quote-unquote stoplight at C5. So you're okay with that? I guess you left, Roy.
I guess so. Hank, are you out there? Yeah, I guess he had to step away.
Yeah, you probably noticed this, Roy. When I do things like this, I tend to basically lie. I tell little white lies when I think will be more understandable to people who aren't fully up to speed on this. And some people get very upset about that, and some people love it. Well, let me go over. All right, here's the story. There was a plane landing at, what's it, Haneda or something, airport in Tokyo. And it was fairly straightforward. It's at night. Air traffic control is leading them down, you know, the normal way, down to the runway. Meanwhile, as this often happens all the time, there were many other planes running around the airport, and one, a Coast Guard -8, was involved. Now, let me point out something here. A very key part of this, there has been a major earthquake in Tokyo, like 24 hours before that incident happened. And what happened was, a lot of people were scrambling to do what they could to help in the disaster area, and that included the Japanese Coast Guard. By the time this accident happened, there was no member of the Japanese Coast Guard who was completely exhausted, stressed out, and burned out. And that includes the crew of a Coast Guard aircraft that had been supporting the relief effort. Now, just for the record, the airplane is a